Welcome, everybody, to Productivity Book Group. I'm your host and facilitator, Ray Sidney Smith. Thanks for joining us here on the live call or on the podcast for Productivity Book Group. Today, on this call, we will be discussing Talent is Overrated, What Really Separates World-Class Performers from Everybody Else. We'll be discussing chapters 7 through 11, and the book is by Jeff Colvin, who I introduced in the last recording in the last call. And so we're gonna jump right in and really talk about everyone's reaction to the balance of talent is overrated. So in the last call, we talked about the first six chapters and really walked ourselves through the deliberate practice process. And now in this second part of the book, he really goes into applying the deliberate practice models or deliberate practice in general into our lives and organizations. And then he closes out the book by talking about innovation or creativity and sort of the purpose of that within deliberate practice, or maybe the ability to use deliberate practice to have innovation and creativity both as an individual and in an organization. And then he talks about when to start deliberate practice, you know, early as possible for children and so on and so forth, and we'll talk about some of those things. And then he ends the book with sort of a discussion about passion, the drive to actually implement deliberate practice. You know, why would you do it in the first place, considering that, you know, that final item that he consistently talks about here is that deliberate practice is hard. It's a really difficult process, and not many people endeavor it. So why should we? So just starting that out, what are everyone's thoughts regarding this second half of Talent is Overrated?
I loved it. I thought it was right on.
Oh, wonderful. I really like Chapter 7, because Chapter 7 felt like it applied all of the principles that the book started with. You know, so that's sort of my favorite chapter. And then the rest of the book seems of interest to me, but Chapter 7 really was like the crowning achievement in the book for me, and I really enjoyed that. I'm going to kick us off into Chapter 7, which is, you know, he entitled Applying the Principles in Our Lives. And so he brings up this notion of three different models, the music, chess, and sports model, for implementing deliberate practice. And I'm curious about what you all thought about the different models, you know, which ones you might apply in your own life, and really the general thoughts he had about implementing deliberate practice in your individual life. And I think he gave a great argument for starting with the self as opposed to starting with an organization, and I'm curious about people's sort of thoughts there.
Well, given that organizations are hierarchical and you know, kind of hard to move, you know, it's like steering a big ship, it would make sense to start individually and then, you know, kind of expand outward from there, because it would be, I think, harder for an organization to change their corporate culture if they are kind of anti, you know, deliberate practice, Kanban, and innovation, you know, so, yeah.
And it might be that they're just... Yeah, and they might just be ignorant of it. I mean, it's not even necessarily being anti, but they just might not know it exists, you know. And because you have silos of knowledge throughout an organization, and you have a lot of people leaving organizations faster than they've ever left in prior generations, you know, they just might not know, you know. And so yeah, I think that it's certainly important for us all to take heart that deliberate practice needs to be consistently extolled in public environments in a company, and that really helps things. But we'll talk about that more in Chapter 8. And so let me give sort of an overview of the models, because I think that people generally I think that would generally be helpful to people. So the music model is where you practice something that's written down. So it applies well in sort of writing or giving persuasive presentations. You know, you're trying to deliver some kind of product. In the chess model, you are studying from well-practiced masters. So you're learning what people have done and studying those as a premise for what's going to happen in the future as an archetype. And so this is frequently called the case method, also, you know, the Harvard University concept of the case method. And so you're presented with a problem, and then you are charged with coming up with a plan of action to try and solve that problem, and you want to, of course, focus on specific skills. And then finally, there's the sports model, which is where it's sort of like a strength and endurance of a specific skill process. So you're taking the needs to be able to build skills. Those might be cognitive or physical, but the idea is building up a mental or physical model that you can continue to keep growing on top of. So with that in mind, how might you apply these in your own life? I mean, the whole idea of the deliberate practice concept is that you should apply them in your life. And so how might you take one of these models and implement them in your own life?
I think that all three models are valid depending on what it is that you want to work on. And he mentioned, the practice of the skill set practice, which I equate more with music, and he used tennis as an example. Also, with things like presentations in the book, and basically reworking the Benjamin Franklin writing improvement self course that he mentioned in the book. And then, with the case method model, it kind of in predicting maybe more in terms of like maybe marketing, what other companies have done, and then maybe trying to implement them, or introducing a new product to a different to your whoever your customers are might be, I think he mentioned something like that, something similar in terms of presenting products to see what other companies have done with new markets, and the sports model in conditioning and working on specific skills, where he mentions reinforcing older skills, previously acquired skills, in an attempt to not just learn new ones, but to kind of facilitate the cognitive map or cognitive mapping that happens whenever you're trying to maybe solve a problem that hadn't come up before. And that he said the more rich and dense your cognitive map is, the more likely it is that you could come up with an innovative solution to a problem that that presents itself to a company.
So what's one thing in your life, area in your life, Miranda, that you feel like you're poised to sort of use deliberate practice in order to grow, develop, be more productive?
Well, the deliberate practice, the method that I've chosen to do is in music, and I'm in addition to some other things, I'm also I'm going to be taking a course on composition, but it's going to be unlike other musical composition courses that I've taken. This particular one will be focused on using the rules that exist in the 17th and 18th century. So I will be confined to that skill set. So it will build on previously acquired skills, music theory, music history, that I already have, reinforce those, and then make me, instead of writing whatever I want to write and whatever style I want to write, force me to use those skills in a very confined kind of framework. I think it'll
great. That sounds, that sounds like a really fun task. So that's really cool.
Yeah, I'm excited.
So, John, you were trying to speak earlier.
Yeah. I was going to say something just about a few things. So one is that I guess what I was going through my mind, there were a few things that were kind of going through my mind as I the entire time I was reading the book. One, which you didn't really get to until the end, which is why, right? Like, what's the point? You got to have, why would somebody put themselves through this? And he doesn't get to it until kind of the very end, which,
mm-hmm.
There've been lots of books, there's plenty of stuff kind of written about that. But I thought it was interesting that he closed with that because.
So you felt like he should have started with it? Well, John, I'm not sure where you went. We may have lost you. But you know, it's sort of interesting. You know, since Simon Sinek has written the Start with Why sort of book, and not sort of book, the book, and you know, has really lectured on that quite widely. You know, it's interesting that people now are so aware of the fact that the reasons, you know, so what's in it for me, and the why of you know, any premise really should be stated up front. And so I actually agree. I think that he should have probably put that up front. But notwithstanding, it was sort of like a motivating uptick at the end of the book for me as well to have it repeated since there's, you know, since so many people have actually sort of expanded upon this. You know, Drive by Daniel Pink and other people like that have already expounded upon the concept.
So I haven't actually read Drive. I have it somewhere. I will get to it at some point, but that's
good book.
A good reason to do it. But the other aspect to that, which I thought was interesting, was the way that there's, you know, and I think I'm trying to remember who it was that I'd read something more about this previously, but there's an interplay between the talent portion and the passion portion, right? Neither one can really propel you all the way, and they can't. One could potentially get you started, but there's got to be like a constant, I would say, back and forth between the two that says, yeah, keep, you know, let's keep going at with this. So, you know, you can very easily think of how awesome it would be to be a concert pianist, right? And how much you would love to do that. But when you sit down, when you sit down to do the practice, you need that. I think what he was talking about in the book was how children, when this is, you know, in the cases where this is started with children, they're starting in with these skills in a great deal in isolation. So they don't need there aren't these competing forces, these things that are dissuading them from going forward. You know, when we grow up, we can't get away from all the dissuading. You know, it's really hard to get away from all the things that try to stop you from doing something, telling you, you know, there's no point in this, or, you know, there's so many people who are better than you, or all of that.
And the opportunities. I mean, you know, like my big issue with all of this is that, you know, my focus in youth was so specific. You know, I was given one thing to do, if maybe five things to do at any given particular time in my early development. And, you know, I was capable of really laser focus on that particular thing, and it allowed me great mastery very quickly. And today,
the martial arts that you were talking about?
Exactly. Well, martial arts or just reading or whatever it might have been. Yeah, you had only so many things that you had to do. You know, everything else was sort of taken care of for you, you know, from you know, preparing and maintaining your general life was taken care of. And so today, where, you know, it's you've got to do your own stuff, you know, your own laundry and that kind of thing. And then on top of that, you know, for me especially, I think one of my greatest challenges, and I think many people share this in the productivity community, is, you know, there's so many opportunities like, oh, I want to learn this new thing, and I want to learn that new thing, and I want to develop that skill better. And, you know, it's like I have all of these various things that I want to do. And at the end of the day, you have to just capture them all onto a someday maybe list, onto a bucket list of some kind, because you just can't do all of them at the same time. And, you know, so I myself have been challenged with that, and you know, GTD has obviously helped me corral that, but you still have that sense of, you know, yearning because it's like, oh, you know what, I'd really love to learn this new programming language, and yet, you know, you have so many other things going on. Those things need to be done before you can get to it.
Yeah, that's all the things that are competing outside of for our attention from outside us, saying, I need this. You know, everything from people close to us to the government to our bosses, if we have them, or whatever. Everybody's. And then what are all the competing internal forces to say, oh, this is what I really want to do. No, this is what I really want to do. No, this is what I really want to do. And what I'm facing personally right now is, you know, there's something that I've been thinking about for a long time, and it looks really interesting, and it has a lot of the components of, you know, of something that is really interesting to me. But it's not one skill. There are probably a dozen skills that are a part of this that I need to work on as part of this whole thing. That where to begin, you know?
Right, and deliberate practice is probably not the appropriate framework for that, then, you know, because it's not going to give you progress in the whole, you know. It's only about developing specific skills really, really well, mastery in one particular focus. So, you know, it's like you have to sort of pick and choose your appropriate tools here, and I don't think deliberate practice is probably the appropriate tool here. And
right. So,
you know,
the flip side of the deliberate practice and mastery is, I think it was a book group titled a few months ago, The First 20 Hours, by Josh Kaufman, which is, you know, the quick and dirty, you know, get yourself up and running fast skill building book.
Yeah, rapid skills acquisition, absolutely. Yeah, I would say that's definitely, if you're trying to develop several different skills very, very quickly, you know, you can only do one at a time, so you've got to choose that one first thing, you know, that you want to learn, that one first skill. But, you know, 20 hours a piece sounds a heck of a lot, you know, easier as a beginning point than 10,000 hours. So, you know, I think that's where you have to hedge your bets that you're going to get competent in it as opposed to mastery in it.
Yeah. So here's a question maybe for the group. I don't know if others on the call have kids. I have a 6-year-old and a 10-year-old, both boys. I'm just curious if anybody else has kids, because
well, I've younger siblings who I feel like are my kids, but
okay.
I don't have I you know, they're now, you know, they're 20 and 20 to 24 now, so I mean they're older now, thank goodness. But they're not adolescents anymore.
Yeah.
Ray.
So,
Miranda, go for it. Yeah, go ahead, Miranda.
The concepts that I really focused on in my notes here, and there are several that I found exciting that I'd like to talk a little bit, you know, about in as much detail as we can manage in the half hour we have left. Brain plasticity, learned helplessness, self-regulation versus self-talk, the concept of flow that he was talking about, myelination, and cognitive domain mapping.
Okay.
You know, reading these concepts, you know, I mean, the book was extremely exciting. You know, it was a hopeful book, and I was really kind of excited by these ideas. And, you know, in some books and things that I had read before, one book in particular, The Inner Game of Music, I think there's a book called The Inner Game of Golf, and then there were a series of books based on, you know, different fields of endeavor that were, introduced, and the concept he said of self-regulation kind of contrasts a little bit with what the concept of self-talk during practice So I'd like to talk a little bit about that, the cognitive domain mapping and how it relates to innovation. And then that feeling of learned helplessness when he talked about how average performers attribute their lack of success to factors outside of their control. It kind of reminds me of that whole concept of that. And so I just wanted to know, in brain plasticity, how, you know, it's really not confined to, yes, you know, children's brains are very malleable, but it doesn't stop. You know, brain plasticity continues lifelong. So there's hope for people, and that deliberate practice staves off age-related decline. I mean, all of these things were just, you know, like nuggets, jewels, you know, for me, and I was so excited in reading the book. So can we talk about those?
Sure, we can try to cover as much as we can in the time that we have, and so there's two particular books that I would make a recommendation of in that process, and that's just because that's what I do. But the two books that I would make a recommendation of are Brain Rules by, I believe it's John Medina, and then The Organized Mind by Daniel Levitin, and that's still currently, I think, in hardcover and quite a big book, so it's not an easy endeavor. But if you're really trying to understand a lot of what is being discussed here in terms of the cognitive neuroscience behind what's happening here, those two books I think will be really good sort of deep dives into those. I think.
Oh no, I understand the concepts. I want to discuss them.
So, so what did you specifically want to talk about regarding self-regulation?
Okay, well, the self-regulation versus self-talk, negative self-talk during practice, and, you know, it's, he said that superior performers actually are kind of observing themselves and adjusting as they go along, and then they're, you know, they have a specific skill set that they want to work on from the outset. They don't just approach the problem just kind of going in and figuring it, you know, and just saying, well, whatever happens, happens. They actually have an approach and a method before they go in there. Then when they're practicing that particular skill set, you know, they're monitoring themselves to see how they're doing, and making adjustments during the practice. And afterwards, there's a review, kind of a debriefing that, you know, goes on with the self to analyze how what was done, what went wrong, what went right, and then, you know, a strategy for practicing this again. You know, what will I change? What will I do differently? So that's kind of the thing that I had encountered before, what I was told by teachers, is that, you know, it's not productive to monitor yourself during practice. I mean, because, you know, you can discourage yourself when you are practicing by saying, oh, that was so bad, or I didn't do that right, or I, you know, and then you lose focus on the actual performance. You're taking your mind, you know, practicing is not a function of the ego. It is getting into the music and trying to bring out the idea that the composer had to convey. So I just kind of want to talk about that. So I've actually been taught the opposite, that, you know, you do your monitoring afterwards, but while you're practicing, when you're performing, you just don't do that. So do you have any thoughts?
I certainly have thoughts, which is, you know, self-regulation, I mean, also known as executive function, is not really in conflict with what you're talking about. I mean, it just naturally happens. So, you know, the reality is that you might control your impulse. I mean, executive function or self-regulation is just controlling one's impulses. You know, being aware of it, getting feedback by virtue of this. And I think that Josh Kaufman in The First 20 Hours gives a good argument for that as well. But here, Jeff Colvin is basically stating that you want as immediate feedback as possible so that you can improve upon that one specific skill that you're trying to learn better. I think that if on a general level you're trying to learn, skills, you know, like if you're trying to learn to play the clarinet, you know, in general at that point, you may not want to be so specific with your critical thoughts on what you're doing. But if you get to a competent level of playing, say a beginner or intermediate level, that's where you need to then start looking at self-regulation as he sort of applies it within deliberate practice to start to be more critical of the minutia of the details, because it's on the margins that you're really growing. That's sort of how I can appreciate it within that, still fitting within the guidelines of what you've been taught.
Okay. And I,
you know, like, yeah, so it's like, don't feel like you have to lose, you can lose yourself in music, you know, in playing, but at the same time, if you want to develop a specific skill, you've got to do something with it, which is maybe recording yourself, video recording to show, see technique and all those kinds of things, or audio recording yourself, or having a coach, you know, and that helps to alleviate some of that self-criticism potentially that you're doing. That's not really self-regulation, though. It's being critical. It's not being, it's being critical about the components, not being critical of yourself.
Okay, got it. That I understand better now.
And so then you wanted to talk a little bit about neuroplasticity, and
yes.
So what did you want to discuss regarding neuroplasticity?
Well, just the fact that, you know, it was that the science supports the fact that that the deliberate self-practice can stave off those age-related, declines that happen to all of us. And I found it, you know, encouraging. You talked about Rubinstein, you know, performing well into his 80s, and, you know, how that deliberate practice, and it sort of clicked for me. He said deliberate practice is focused on overcoming limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're younger and you're practicing, your limitations are, you know, developing your hand-eye coordination, which actually doesn't change as you get older, because, you're still developing your hand-eye coordination, but you can't, from the perspective of not being able to do maybe the things that you used to do, but you can still, with deliberate practice, find strategies to achieve that same goal. Neuroplasticity part of it, meaning, you know, that not only can you refine skills previously learned, but you can grow, if there's a demand for it, you can grow new neurons. Yay! I'm like, you can? Oh, wow! You know, I was mostly excited by the ideas, because science has come along. So, you know, one of the things that I was an avid learner of, for studier, I'm so excited I can't even talk. As a minor, I studied the physiological psychology. And so I was so interested into that and in that. And I was really interested in how, you know, chemically and, electrophysiologically the brain does what it does. And so to hear that the science has actually evolved since when I was in school, where they said, yeah, brain plasticity is a thing that happens in kids and then you just lose it, you know, to hear that, no, you don't, it's really hopeful. one can approach learning skills from the standpoint of here's this big task that I have to do, and it's going to take me so many hours, and I don't know if I'm going to do it. Or you can approach it like it's a possible, it's a thing, it's doable, it's possible, and all I have to do is start. Like we talk about in the meetings, in the productivity meetings, you know, you just have to start the task. You're not asked to finish mm-hmm. it in one gulp. You just have to start it. But the thing is that even older folks, you know, can do this. This is something doable. And it's not that you can't, that adage, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, is just plain wrong.
And it has been for quite some time.
Yeah. So I'm like excited, you know, because as I'm getting older, I don't see the desire. I haven't lost the desire to learn new stuff, and now I have the capability to do it. You know, it's not that I'm gonna. You know, we're not all descending into the tunnel. I mean, I know there are cognitive disorders in which people lose brain function, so I'm not speaking of that. But, you know, for the majority of us that don't, you know, fall into that category, it means that at age is not, will you surrender to your daily demands and whatever, you know, things that you have to do in your life. You can also make time for this thing, and you don't have to make time to finish it. You just have to make time to start it, but it's possible. And just because you happen to be of a certain age doesn't mean you can't try. You can do it. Your brain can do it. It's wired to do that, to help you to continue to grow.
What I'll say about brain plasticity or neuroplasticity as it's understood now is that so recently I had the opportunity to write a guest blog post about Evernote and I'll provide a link in the show notes on orderyourlife.net, which is Penny Catterall's blog, and she's a professional organizer. And so the blog post that I wrote was really about, you know, the extended mind or the concept of the extended mind and why I chose Evernote to be that part of that technology that I use for the extended mind. And a really important piece of research that's come out this past year in 2014 was that forgetting is an active process of the brain. And that's really quite monumental when you think about it, because what it says is that if you can never forget anything, your brain can never grow. And so plasticity allows us to be able to forget as much as it allows us to remember. And I think that writing and rewriting of the brain's neuropathways is really a fundamental sort of building block for deliberate practice, or at least, you know, as a proponent for deliberate practice and using it as a framework. And so we all have to remember that, you know, the brain is not a fixed brick. You know, it's not just this thing that sits there and does, you know, collects and collects and collects and then just holds it. You know, it selectively imprints and selectively deletes things as it's necessary, as it believes it's necessary. That doesn't necessarily always mean that it's right, but for the most part, if we collect properly, then it will capture properly and then recollect that information when necessary. And so it is a really important, and I think the science is really developing quite fascinating. So we talked about neuroplasticity. How about cognitive mapping? What did you want to talk about regarding cognitive mapping within Talent is Overrated?
Cognitive domain mapping, you know, to address that thing that's, you know, that says that, you know, that basically you have to bring somebody in that doesn't know anything about it to make a comment to help you see out of the box or see outside the box or out whatever is wrong. That the more extensive your knowledge, the more rich and dense your cognitive domain is, the more likely it is that you can draw upon that experience to innovate. And so, you know, it's kind of like, you know, again, it's, you know, I'm not trying to be, you know, it isn't, you know, that innovation is not limited to people that don't know very much about a subject. You know, you don't invite somebody that doesn't know anything about your subject to, you know, come in and take a look at this and tell me what I'm doing and help me to see it right. Because basically, you know, they may end up reinventing the wheel. But on the other hand, it's putting value on the knowledge that we already have and the workers that we already have that have an extensive and rich history of knowledge to draw upon, and encouraging them to use that, incorporate all of that new, that stuff that they've learned, to apply it to a problem. So he said innovation just doesn't come out of nowhere. There's a long preparatory process before you come up with this new thing. And that I have a, you know, there's a feeling I get sometimes, you know, in just discussing like work environments and things where, you know, it's kind of like, oh, you know, we got to hire these new folks, you know, because they have the new this and the new that, without, and not valuing our older workers because for the rich history that they bring to their jobs. And I think it's a, you know, the ideal situation would be a synthesis between, you know, somebody that has a perspective where they don't have that framework of knowledge, but maybe some ideas, and then using that, the people that have that rich, you know, history, that, you know, work experience history, to actually innovate. It should be between the one and the other. It's like you don't throw out your older workers because they're older and their ideas are outdated. They have all of this information to draw on, and you know that they can see. So, you know, for example, at work I was working on a problem with a particular computer. Had I not known anything about computers, I wouldn't have been able to solve the problem. But the normal routes of getting to a solution were unavailable to me. And I remembered something that I had learned a while ago and thought, okay, if I do this with this, it's not the normal way to do it, but if I do it that way, I wonder if what would happen. And it was a solution to the problem. So without all of that experience and that knowledge to draw upon for this particular computer problem, it wouldn't have been solved. And had I not known anything about computers and tried to solve the problem, I would have failed. So that's kind of what I just wanted to say about that.
Right, and so this is Chapter 9, which is entitled Performing Great at Innovation. And so sort of bringing other people back into the call, what were your thoughts on innovation before reading Talent is Overrated? What do you think now about, you know, sort of creativity and this notion that Colvin is really positing here, which is that innovation and creativity are something that's built upon from deep domain knowledge, not necessarily from any kind of shallow knowledge. Do you believe that deep domain knowledge is now an only path to creative output? Do you believe that creative output can happen in these sort of sparks of innovation that have come up in what's, you know, sort of common mythology?
Me or everyone?
Everyone, you, anyone.
I have changed my mind. I was kind of, you know, I really kind of felt like, you know, that they, you know, the you know, you have to, I don't know, I guess I thought the way that people think that, you know, and I don't believe that now after reading that and then after having rethinking some things, you know, and I think what I had believed before was wrong.
You know, it's funny, John Cleese, yeah. and this has come. Go ahead, John.
I was just going to say, you know, it's. I would say it's not that it can't happen, but it's not the only reliable way is through deep domain knowledge. You know, what he talks about we're creating more and more and more knowledge every second that passes in every one of these, in all these different areas, until there's something new where there isn't, you know, and I don't know, there's every once in a while we do have new things, right? Mm-hmm. Social networks and the internet and all that is fairly new. So, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it's new. So innovations can happen with less knowledge, but the more mature that any domain becomes, the longer and longer it takes to for new innovations to happen and for someone to acquire the knowledge necessary for those innovations.
Right, so I'm gonna challenge this concept just a little bit, which is that I don't disagree that deep domain knowledge is a creative path, you know, and one that innovation gains a benefit for having. Deep domain knowledge is definitely one of them, but it's not the only one. And I think that he believes that if you stand on deep domain knowledge alone, that organizations and individuals will gain the most benefit from deep domain knowledge. And again, I'm not making an argument against deep domain knowledge. I think that it's one of several that I think work really well. And John Cleese has actually talked about this. You know him as the comedian performer on Monty Python. But in his after, you know, sort of Monty Python years, he's studied imagination, creativity, and innovation, and has talked quite widely on the subject. And one of the things he talks about is the ability to sort of prime your brain for creative output. And so, you know, it's not necessarily always about deep domain knowledge, because sometimes if you just position yourself with a problem, you know, I may know nothing about straws, but if I wanted to innovate on the idea of straws, all I needed to do was really to prime my brain on, you know, whatever the problem with straws are, I don't know. But then, you know, going through this process that John Cleese talks about of priming and then problem solving gives the brain the opportunity to really do that. And I think it's all about focus, which again fits into deep domain knowledge, but not necessarily having the knowledge part, but just the focus aspect of it, so that you're capable of eliminating all of the other, you know, sort of distractions that are going on, and just by primarily focusing on that particular issue starts to generate ideas, you know, and new solutions or potentially new ideas. The other side to this is that what most of innovation how most innovation happens is through pattern recognition, at least in the problem solving realm. And so if you think about it from that perspective, that if you're trying to problem solve, you know, if I know a little bit about a lot of different industries, that allows me to be able to see patterns that may not exist if I only understand one industry really, really well. Okay, so while I don't believe that knowing one industry really, really well gives you that sort of like myopic view, it doesn't give you the opportunity to actually see what is outside of it. You know, I might find that solution to the straw. You know, straws are fragile or something like that. You know, I might find that pipes made out of aluminum, which I don't recommend anyone try to make a straw out of aluminum. But the point is that, you know, knowing something about pipes might influence the creative output for creating a better straw. So it's actually the connectivity of pattern recognition that this is applied here. So it's not the only path. That's my only argument.
Yeah, and I was just saying that there's, you know, it definitely depends on the, it depends on different aspects, right? Of the pattern recognition, or you know, the ability to kind of see what. New combinations of things, because everything really is, you think about all these different, every new innovation a lot of our common and contemporary new innovations are just combinations of existing innovations, right? So,
right.
What are we combining to in a new way, by combining those things, you create something completely unexpected, right? So I guess I'm maybe repeating what you were saying, right? But what interesting knowledge is there in another domain that could apply in this or that domain?
Absolutely, and I think a lot of that is built into sort of how the Socratic method works, you know, because it extracts from people not necessarily the specific answer of what's trying to be pulled from you, but that you're relating the backgrounds that you have from different areas of your life to be able to mesh together or patchwork together a problem. So we're in our final minutes, and so I wanted to make sure that we covered anything that we haven't yet covered that anyone has any burning thoughts on. So that might be on topics of passion or, you know, using deliberate practice in adulthood, since, you know, most of us are not, I'm presuming, not children, so the whole idea of using an early development is sort of out of the question for us. And any other questions about applying the principles in organizations from Chapter 8 and 9? Is there any hot-button issue you wanted to sort of close out the discussion with?
The idea that you and John were discussing about, you know, new ideas actually being permutations of older ideas, and the difficulty that we probably, as you and John mentioned, that that as we progress technologically, it becomes it takes longer and longer, and he said this in the book too, it takes longer and longer to achieve a certain level of mastery before you can contribute something new, which then the problem with that is then we become specialists, because it takes so long to absorb all of this information that, you know, we have to narrowly focus, like, you know, like laser-like focus on this one particular discipline or field in order to achieve a certain level of mastery. And so then we lose that more generalist view of the world where we can draw from, you know, observations of this or that other industry to help us to innovate in the one that we happen to be participating in. So it's good to have an extensive background of knowledge and in a particular field, but having the time then to also study generally other fields and then wait for that observation that will help you solve that problem, I think is harder to do.
Well, that's why I think that, you know, you bring up a great point, and I think the difficulty dissipates to some extent. For me, what I've found is that while I have, you know, a particular area in which I focus in my work life professional world, and I've chosen that to be my deep domain knowledge world, I happen to have hobbies, and it's through those things that also interest me outside of my professional world that allows me to, you know, develop other sort of, it is deep domain knowledge. It's just deep domain knowledge outside of the focus of my work world. And many times those other areas influence my work world because I'm relating how the two different things are operating. So, you know, while I might find that I'm very interested in, you know, web programming languages, and so I might learn web programming in one area, that is definitely going to influence, I mean, because they're both technology related in terms of my own, you know, professional world, they influence each other, but they wouldn't have to be. You know, if I were still in the legal profession, I could easily see how the you know, web languages were and could be applied in, you know, a particular case that I was litigating or something like that. You know what I mean? It's all about understanding. It's all about finding motivation in the things that you are drawn to and choosing deliberate practice in those particular areas. And I think that can overcome some of the barrier. Does that make any sense, Miranda?
Oh, absolutely. It certainly does. I just, you know, we train specialists, not generalists these days. And so I was just saying that, you know, it's going to be harder for people to draw from different disciplines to solve their particular problem in their area because of the educational focus, you know, that we have, having to be that way because of the extensive knowledge that it takes to master a subject before you can go on to contribute something new. That's all I was saying.
Absolutely.
I've got one quick observation on that, what she was referring to, and that is in the corporate world, they desperately need generalists all the time, but they're loath to compensate them or bring them in on board because they're so used to the specialized slotting of employees and org charts and stuff. I've seen this time and again. They need generalists, but they have a really difficult time of dealing with generalists. You know, so I think that's one thing that of a corporate culture resistance issue that's quite considerable.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Dan. I think that it's important for people to recognize that, you know, we either choose to as Colvin argues in the book, to invest in our people, and that people development is really so important because if they do come from a liberal arts background or some other background that doesn't give them the specialist skills that we want them to have, that doesn't mean they can't develop them. We just have to invest in them, and that might be a little bit difficult for people who come from a specialist background, and we sort of have to rein in our own feelings about that in order to be able to move forward. So, any final thoughts before I close out?
Well, the ultimate generalist was this. Or Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. They both were generalists, and neither one had degrees. So, liberal arts or otherwise. So.
That's true. Although I think I think now Gates does have an honorary doctorate from.
That when you become a billionaire, that kind of gets obfuscated a little bit. So.
I know. I find it so sort of comical. I mean, when Bill Gates gave his famous commencement speech, where they honored him with the honorary doctorate, he joked about sort of chiding his father about his dropping out and. So it happens. All right. Well, thank you all so much. This closes out the conversation for Talent is Overrated, What Really Separates World-Class Performers from Everybody Else by Jeff Colvin. I have a couple of announcements before we end the call. First and foremost, if you're a podcast listener listening to this recorded session, the callers you just heard in this episode are readers just like you, and you're more than welcome to join us here on the live calls to discuss productivity books also. Please visit productivitybookgroup.org and find out all the details and the schedule for upcoming book discussion calls there. If you plan to read ahead or read a little bit more slowly, please visit productivitybookgroup.org and check out the schedule on the upcoming books page.
Our next reading selection is Happy Money, The New Science of Smarter Spending by Elizabeth Dunn and Michael Norton. The date of the discussion is February 28th at noon Eastern.
Finally, all podcast episodes are archived at productivitybookgroup.org under episodes. You can also find us in iTunes and Stitcher and other podcatchers. So if you've missed a call and want to review it, feel free to go ahead and head over there to listen to them. Thank you everyone who joined me here on the live call. You make Productivity Book Group awesome, so stay awesome, and here's to your productive life.